I gained a lot of confidence in basically running my own business, since I was doing these house calls and dealing with clients on my own. And I kind of also liked keeping all the money.
Hi, this is Naima LaFon.
It's Alfredo Lewis.
This is Amanda Leiberger.
This is Victor Valverde.
It's Robert Cromines here. Thank you for listening to the Hair Game Podcast.
Hey, listener, I'm Eric Taylor. So what's in the news? Delta seems to be losing steam in most places in the United States. Cases are still high, but they seem to have plateaued and are falling slightly in many, many places. Hospital admissions, for example, for COVID fell last week for the first time in several weeks. Certainly positive news and similar to the trajectory that Delta has taken in the first few countries that it hit, like India. Of course, we're still going to do what we reasonably can to keep ourselves and our clients safe. Maybe that means wearing masks for a little bit longer. Yeah, it's super annoying, but it's not the end of the world. Also, more people are getting vaccinated since Delta started coming out. Some of the people who were on the fence were like, okay, now I'm going to get vaccinated. These are positive moves towards getting back to normal. LA County a couple weeks ago was whispering about writing up details for a vaccine mandate. Of course, that freaked a lot of people out. I certainly don't want a vaccine mandate, but that was a couple weeks ago and I haven't read anything more about it. So the plateauing new cases hopefully have calmed the nerves of the county health people. I'm not sure, but I for one do not want a vaccine mandate. Hopefully the people are coping sufficiently and San Francisco and New York. All right, stimulus money. We always talk about stimulus money here because I want you to get as much stimulus money as possible from the feds or from your state. I don't know as much about the states, of course, because there are 50 of them, but the feds have put something out and they've changed some rules on the Employee Retention Tax Credit, known as ERC. This is for any employer. Could amount to tens of thousands of dollars for each employee. So if you are a salon with a team-based pay system and you have a lot of employee hairdressers, this applies to you. If you're a booth rental salon and you have, let's say, a salon manager, or you have a receptionist or something like that, any employee, this could be awesome for you. The PBFC, Professional Beauty Federation of California, has been leading the way on this, just like they led the way on getting PPP money for people. Go to beautyfederation.org to see if you qualify for this money. Any employer nationwide. Okay, Pod Loot giveaway time. This is the first episode of the month of September. So we are going to give away $500 in cash to one listener who's written us a review on the Apple Podcast app. Let's do it right now. The winner is Eric Gee. E-R-I-C, which incidentally, Eric, is the proper way to spell Eric. E-R-I-C-G-E, Eric Gee. Eric, DM me on Instagram at the Hair Game Podcast and let me know that you heard me call your name and we will send you the $500. You have 2 weeks to claim it. If you don't claim it, we are going to give away $750 next month. More details about the Pod Loot at the end of the show. Now to David John.
Hi, David. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Glad to be here. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. So for the listener's sake, David and I just learned that our kids were baptized in the same church in Westlake Village, California, which is not very common because Westlake is like 45 minutes north of L.A.
That's right. And I live in L.A. and currently it's just that my husband was working there at the time. And so that's why we got baptized there.
There you go. Even in the big city of Los Angeles, it's a small world now and then.
It is. So, a small world after all.
I'm going to introduce you now. You're a Beverly Hills hairstylist. You went to the Sassoon Academy in Santa Monica, which I've spoken at a couple times. I love that place. You've worked at Fred Siegel, Sergey Normant, at John Frieda, and Sally Hershberger salons in LA. You recently opened your studio at Salon Republic Beverly Hills. Modern Salon did an awesome article after you moved. And listeners, for the listeners' sake, Donovan, please post a link of the article in the show notes. Listeners, just go to the show notes to see that article. You've done clients such as Kristen Wiig, Courtney Cox, Brenda Strong, Kristen Johnson. I try not to name drop too much, but Charlie Sheen. Okay, Kevin Bacon, Gabriel Union, and on and on and on. And maybe most fascinatingly, you once served as a Russian linguist in the U.S. Army.
There you go. That's my life. I don't need to talk now.
That's
it. I think we're done. All right. Nice talking to you.
Show's over.
Bye.
Hey, great talking to you, too. So I want to start with the Russian linguist, because I'm not sure. Now, we've had U.S. military. We've had hairdressers who started in the military, but this is slightly different. So tell us, how did you get there?
So I want to take it back another step further, actually, because I was going to college for a year. And what was interesting is I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I went to the career counselor at my school and said, you know, I'm really unsure what major I should pick or what I should do. And they're like, oh, here, just take this computerized test. And so I took this test and I'm filling it out, and I'm everything I'm checking off kind of, I'm like, that seems like it would be good for a designer or something like that. I was thinking maybe I wanted to be a designer. So anyhow, I got the test results back, and out of 100 possible points, I think the score was 103, said that I should be a hairdresser. And I was like, I don't want to be a hairdresser. That's so dumb. I'm joining the Army. I'm going to get some Army College Fund and go to college. So I joined the Army, and I just happened to start cutting friends' hairs in the Army, and I really liked it, and I was good at it. And so I decided to go into hair after that. But when I was in the Army, the career I chose in the Army was a linguist, and they gave me Russian because they needed Russian linguists at the time. It was the tail end of the Cold War. And so I learned Russian intensively for a year at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. And
that's not a bad place to go to learn a language.
I know, right? A little boy from Wisconsin, I was like, California, here I come. It was beautiful, and but it was intense. I think they had like only a 60% passing rate, like 40 people dropped out or couldn't make it through. But I did, and then my job, I was stationed in Germany, and I would eavesdrop on the Russian military that were stationed in East Germany. I was in West Germany, they were in East Germany, and we just listened in on them. It was, like I said, the tail end of the Cold War, and I don't know.
Wow. Okay. So
hold
on.
I never heard anything really good, though.
Okay. Well, no. I was definitely going to ask for the juiciest redacted confidential intel, but okay, you squashed that question. But
sorry.
But going back to, I mean, that's fascinating. Okay, so you went to the Army because the Army, there's a real financial reason to go into the Army, right? They pay for college and they teach you a lot of things, right?
So, yeah. Okay. I figured it also would give me some time to figure out what I wanted to do for sure. Get to travel, see the world, and you know, all that. So
right,
it was a great experience. I'm glad I did it.
So why did they put you into language? Because there's a lot of things that you can do in the Army. Why language?
Right. Well, I had taken German all through high school, and so I knew that I wanted to do this language program that they had. That's what the recruiter said that they had. And then what I had to do was take a proficiency test. And they basically teach you a made-up language on the spot. And you kind of have to decipher it and figure out what was said. It was just all made up. And I scored really well on that, I think, because I had taken German before and had studied the language. But because I had scored high on that test, they gave me one of the more difficult languages, which was Russian.
That's amazing. To learn. So I, for one, I will forever be upset at my parents for not making me as a young kid learn a language. And I'm kind of kidding. I'm not really upset at them. But I wish that I had learned a language at a young age. I wanted to learn languages so badly that in college, I went to Italy for my sophomore year, and I endeavored to learn Italian. My heritage is Italian. My dad is first generation American. My grandfather came over on the boat, like everybody else in the 20s. And I tried really hard to learn Italian. I did okay, but of course that ended. I came back and I haven't spoken Italian since. So I've probably forgotten it all. So how hard is it? I'm fascinated by the intensity of learning a language like Russian. I mean, was it all day, every day? Were you completely engrossed in it for that entire year?
Yeah, they really do a good job of submerging you in the language completely. So all our teachers were native speaking teachers. And then all our exercise, like our PT, all our drills and everything were also done in Russian. Like the signs around the campus were all in Russian and everything. So they encouraged us to also speak with our fellow students also in Russian. But yeah, it makes it easier to learn it that way because it's so submersive, you know.
And so after a year of being submerged in the language,
right,
and maybe
yes,
the culture, I don't know, were they engrossing you in the culture as well?
You know, a little bit, not too much. I mean, one of our teachers was really sweet. She like had a group of us over for dinner and like taught us about the food and things like that. But normally, I don't think they normally go too much into the culture. It's for a specific mission, you know. It's not for pleasure.
Right. Okay. So after a year, were you fluent?
I could have a conversation with somebody, but you know, I think that the people who were more proficient got more difficult jobs of transcribing. My job was to basically listen for any communications that they had and then log down what they were saying. If it was something interesting, I would record it and then pass it on to somebody else who could actually transcribe it.
Got it.
Then that transcription went to somebody who gathered all the information and then sent a report to the Pentagon. That's how we kept tabs on them.
That is super cool. All right. So have you spoken Russian since then?
I haven't kept it up. No, it's and if you don't use it, you lose it. It's true. I look at even like Russian writing, which I used to be able to read, and now I can't even decipher the. I would need to take a refresher course, and it would come back, but it would. I can't do it now.
So my wife and I, she actually wanted to learn languages too, but she never did. So we put our kids in Chinese, and so they've been they've been studying Chinese with tutors since they were born, and it's kind of a grand experiment. You know, at this point they're 8 and 10, and so of course they've got things happening, right? There's baseball or there's art or there's this and that. My daughter loves swimming, so there's these kind of obligations that they have throughout the day. But now it's twice a week that they're doing Chinese. They were doing it this morning. So when I came downstairs for breakfast, I heard them on Zoom with their Chinese tutor speaking Chinese. And I always get a tremendous amount of satisfaction, but who knows how much that they're gonna actually learn. I have no idea. It could be totally fake. They could be just reading off the screen. I have no idea how much they're absorbing.
Eric, that sounds kind of dangerous because they're going to be speaking a language that you do not speak.
Oh.
And they're going to be able to like totally communicate with behind your back and you don't know what you're in for.
That's my dream. My dream is that, and my wife, both of our dreams is for our kids to be scheming behind our backs in fluent Chinese.
Well, we all have our goals, I guess.
All right. So, you said that you started doing hair in the Army. Does the Army not have, you know, designated hairstylists?
So in the Army, there are barbers. And especially at the DLI, apparently the barber there was basically a butcher. He would just buzz everybody's hair and they hated their haircuts. And so after basic training, you know, everybody gets that buzz cut, but you're allowed to grow it out a certain length, but it still has to not touch the tops of your ears or the collar and back of your neck. So my roommate had just asked me, hey, will you just trim around my ears? And so I said, sure. And I took one of those orange handled paper scissors.
Yeah.
And we went out in the hallway and I was just cutting around his his ears so that he wouldn't get in trouble. And this guy walks by. He's like, "Oh, you cut hair? Well, you cut mine sometime?" And I'm like, "Okay, sure." So I ended up started cutting his hair, and then people just started asking me. And I got so popular that I had to start, well, I didn't have to, but I started charging $5 a haircut. And with that extra money, I bought a proper scissors and a little cape and a clippers. And I started a little side business. I would do like five people a night. And,
I love it. Well, you had a full book.
Lined them up. And then I started doing women too. Women wanted me to cut their hair. And like the women soldiers.
So
it was fun.
So hold on. So for the women, of course, there's not just men in the army, but there's a barber that would just mow people down. So what did the women
do? I'm not sure. I guess they would just go to hairstylists. They had their own restrictions. Like it also couldn't touch their collar, so they had to either wear it up in a bun, or I forget what the women's regulations were, but they could go anywhere to get their hair cut.
All right. So you built a military clientele while in the military. And
yes.
then why did you leave the military?
It just wasn't for me. All the restrictive lifestyle. I'm also gay, and it was at that time. It wasn't even don't ask, don't tell. It was like you could not be gay and be in the army.
Wow. So did anyone ask you?
Nobody asked me. No, but it was something that I had to keep under wraps and be careful. What was so interesting is how many gay people there were in the army. I had no idea. But it was like this whole subculture of people that existed that I don't know if anybody knew about, but except for the gay people themselves. But it was really great friendships and stuff that I had there.
Wow, that's fascinating. Okay, so, but you didn't feel like you belonged?
Yeah, it was, you know, I wasn't like one of those, I didn't like playing war as a kid or anything. You know, I think it's more for people who like to do that. And
right.
Like that structured lifestyle and everything. But no, after 4 years was enough. That's all I wanted anyway when I signed up.
That's a long time. So, all right, you left, and then what?
And then, so I was stationed in California for a year, and I kind of liked, growing up in Wisconsin too, you kind of idolize California as being a paradise with beaches and, you know, swimming pools and movie stars. And I thought it would be a great place to do hair since I knew I wanted to get into the hair business. So this is interesting. So I bought a pickup truck, loaded up all my stuff. I had a friend from the army in San Diego. I was going to move to San Diego. But then a friend of mine who was a hairdresser on my way out to California, I said, "So, Michelle, if you could go anywhere to school, where would you go to school to learn hair?" And she said, "Vidal Sassoon." And I was like, "Oh." And so this was before the internet. I actually called the 1-800 number on the back of the shampoo bottle, of Vidal Sassoon shampoo bottle. And I said, "Where's your schools?" And they're like, "Well, we only have one academy in North America, and that's in Santa Monica." And so I went and checked it out, and I fell in love. I thought, "Oh, this is the place to do it. This is great."
Yeah.
So I ended up moving to Santa Monica and all that. It was great. Good decision.
It's located right by 3rd Street Promenade. And for the listeners who don't know, it's three blocks from the beach. It's just a fantastic location. It's super walkable, even when walkable wasn't a thing. And it's a beautiful school. There's some ocean views on the top floor, and it's fantastic. All right, so you went there, and your experience was good, I imagine.
Yeah, it was great. I had, because I'd been cutting hair for like 3 years on my own, I was really comfortable with the scissors in my hand, and I was really eager to learn. And so I did well there. And when I got out,
Hold on, pause.
Sure.
Did you find that you had developed habits that were the wrong habits? Because you're cutting hair, you're doing things on your own for 3 years.
Right.
No one who was properly trained probably opined on your technique. Did you show up there and you felt comfortable with scissors, but they were like, "Oh, you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong"?
I wasn't doing things terribly wrong. It was just slight alterations as to, because I had asked my friends who were hairstylists, you know, how do you cut a one length bob or how do you layer and stuff? And they kind of showed me a little bit. And it was more like eye opening, like, oh, this works so much better this way. And, you know, it wasn't trying to unlearn bad habits, but just add to or, you know, refine what I had already learned, I guess. That's what it felt like anyway.
Got it. Okay, so you get out, and where'd you go?
So I worked at a small salon in Beverly Hills called Parker Adams, and that's where I apprenticed. And I zipped through their apprenticeship program. They were very Sassoon-based and wanted, like, they wouldn't let anybody use round brushes, and they were in a Veda salon, which at the time I thought that was a good product company because they were all natural and everything. I like that. And then after that, I worked at Fred Siegel in Santa Monica for 16 years.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
I know.
Yeah, that's a long time. Great salon.
That was a great place to, it was a great place to grow. And
Yeah. All right. And then you worked at these other fantastic salons. Talk to the new hairdressers who are either considering becoming a hairstylist or in school or just recently out of school. What steps do they need to take? I'm going to ask a couple layered questions here, and then you can take your answer wherever you want. Mm-hmm. What are the steps they need to take? What are the habits that they need to get used to? Let's just leave it there with those two questions.
Sure. Well, I feel like beauty school education is not enough. And I think that you really learn the best of your skills when you apprentice at a place. And also just watching your fellow workers and how they do things. I think if you can get into a salon or a space where you're learning, and that is also going to, you know, help you build a clientele, that would be key to start off, I think. I'm glad that that's what I did, and that's what I would suggest to anybody getting into this business.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So nowadays, obviously, we've got the gram. And we've got everything else, and it's allowing some of the younger people to build clients earlier than before.
Yeah.
You know, we at Salon Republic, we've been doing it 21 years, and for the first, let's say, three quarters of those 21 years, we wouldn't take people who were just out of school. Mm. But more recently, some of these kids are coming out of school, and they have full books already. And so things have changed around. With that context, do you still advise that somebody go to an apprenticeship program?
It's interesting because this industry has changed so dramatically since I had started out. And the whole Instagram has totally changed the game of doing hair now. I do feel, though, that people need to learn, and so long as perhaps they're getting an education some other way, like taking classes or YouTube videos or whatever, and I guess there is an amount of natural skill that you need to be able to do that, and if you don't have that, then you definitely need to be in an environment where you can, like, pick up those skills, perhaps.
So while working... And you've been doing hair how long now?
I don't know, 30 years?
So over these 30 years, you've gone from great salon to great salon. You've seen people succeed. You've seen people fail. What are the people doing who are failing? Why are they failing?
I think that people perhaps get into this industry not knowing what it's truly like, and they're seeing other people have really good success at it, and it's perhaps not a natural path for them, and So if somebody's not succeeding, they're probably not enjoying it, and they're probably maybe not good at it, or as good as they thought they were. And so if they're not liking the results of their path that they've chosen, then it's time to rethink your career options or your career choice, and then and get out and do something else that you think that you're better at and that you enjoy more.
Is it mostly, does it come down to technical skill, to the quality of cut, the quality of color, et cetera, or something else?
I think the most important thing is having a good eye for style and design, and being able to translate that with your hands, being able to create that with your hands is another technical skill that you do need to a point. But I really think that I know hairdressers who don't have good technical skills, but they're amazing because they have the gift of vision, and they can create really beautiful styles, perhaps not technically, but like more freehand and more and they're awesome and they're successful and they're great. So
can that be learned? Or is the really you're talking about taste, right? To some degree.
Totally. Yes. And
can taste be learned?
I wonder, actually. I kind of don't think it can be. It's a good point. I think you need to have good taste. Well, I mean, maybe there's clients, though, who don't have good taste, and they want somebody who doesn't have good taste either, right?
Oh, or maybe they just don't recognize the person who has bad taste.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a very interesting philosophical conversation. That's probably an additional entire episode of the podcast. Can good taste be learned? And of course, the funny thing about taste is it's totally subjective. Well, not totally. It's somewhat subjective. And so
right.
I think everybody thinks they have good taste because that's their taste, right? No, I think
nobody says, yeah, right. That I don't have good taste, but right.
Right. They like this, and by definition to them, that's good taste, that they like that.
Right.
Yeah. It's design is a very philosophical thing. All right. So for the Wisconsin hairdresser who's like, David crushed it. I want to go work in LA and do stars. Is it all roses? Is it as good as it seems? What would you say to that person?
For me, Eric, when I envisioned coming out to California and doing hair, I had a different vision of how it was going to be. I thought I would be working on movie sets, perhaps, or doing photo shoots and doing all this editorial work. And I kind of dabbled in a little bit. I even went to makeup school thinking I was going to do hair and makeup for sets and whatnot and for photography. But it's kind of like that didn't turn out for me, and it's not something that I ended up liking doing. So I think that you have to keep an open mind with perhaps your dreams, because they can change and they don't necessarily turn out exactly. But in this industry, there's a lot of room for different avenues to go, for sure.
No doubt about it.
You could just be a colorist if you just like color. You can just be, you know, especially at Salon Republic, people specialize in just, you know, hair straightening or, you know, men's cuts or whatever. It's very departmentalized in that regard. But whatever piece of it really speaks to you, you can really do well in that.
Absolutely. I've always said that this industry has a place for just about anybody. I mean, if you don't like touching heads, you can go work for a product company, right? And use your experience and some of your passions for hair and beauty in general working for a product company, or you can do marketing for a company. There's so many different things, which is one of the things that I like about it so much. So how did the whole COVID thing affect you? I mean, in California, it was 3 shutdowns. It was probably, I haven't done the math, but probably 15 months. How did it affect you personally and professionally?
I feel a very fortunate in some ways. I think that I was able to get through it without really affecting my income. Like, some people were hit very hard, and I was able to get some support. I got a PPP loan, and I got some unemployment, which helped in the beginning. And a lot of my clients still needed their hair done, and so they reached out to me, and I still was able to do them without the salon. I know that was just a survival thing. I've never ever done house calls my whole career. I just didn't enjoy doing that, and I was kind of forced into doing it just to help them out and to help me out financially as well. So I learned a lot doing that. It was a great experience. It was also kind of fun to see where my clients lived. I've known a lot of them for years and how they lived, and it was fun in that regard. But it was scary not knowing about transmission and everything. So being very ultra sanitary and wearing masks and socially distancing and all that, we got through it. I didn't get COVID. I'm fully vaccinated now. And I was, whatever, Tuesday morning, my mask was off. I was ready to go. So that was great. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I followed all the rules all the way along the way. And but now I'm done. I'm ready to not wear a mask anymore.
Yeah.
So that's great.
I think that story is very common. A lot of people had to do what they had to do, especially moving through last summer. It seemed like by, let's say, July, that was, what, 3-4 months removed from before, right before we got shut down. So a lot of clients were like, I was super COVID safe for the last 3 or 4 months, but now my roots are showing. So, we've got to do something about this. And I know that my hair was getting bushy and curly, and so we had to do what we had to do. And that caused a lot of us to do things that we had never done before. And you said you learned a lot. What other things did you learn?
I learned that it kind of gave me confidence. I've never ever thought about going out on my own. I've always kind of not hid behind the crutch of a salon, but I've always kind of taken a back seat to just letting somebody else run the show, and me just show up and do my clients and leave. And I've kind of always liked that my whole 30 years of doing hair. And what this pandemic did was it kind of shook things up for me, and I was forced to essentially run my own business. And I learned that I could do it, and I'm capable of handling, booking appointments and, buying all my color and products and organizing, and all that stuff. And I kind of liked being, in charge of everything. And, that's when I decided that I wanted to open up my own studio at Your Space. I gained a lot of confidence in basically running my own business, since I was doing these house calls and dealing with clients on my own. And I kind of also liked keeping all the money. When the salons reopened in the interim, for however many weeks, and I went back to work and clients started booking in to the salon, I was in my mind, I was like, are you sure you don't want me to do a house call? Are you sure? Because I know that I was only going to get a percentage of that money. And, I still, I've lost clients from the pandemic. Like, people have lost their jobs, or they just are not comfortable coming to seeing anybody or whatever. And the fewer amount of clients that I'm seeing has balanced out the amount of extra money that I'm getting. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, the extra money that you're getting has balanced out the fewer clients that are coming in so far. Now,
and I'm also not able to do as many clients right now because I'm used to working with an assistant and double booking and all that. And I haven't done that since I've moved to the Salon Republic. I don't know if I'm going to end up getting an assistant or if I'm just going to keep going solo. I'm still testing the waters on that, but
yeah,
I'm busy.
The rules are they now allow you to double book if you want. And of course, many independent hairdressers have assistants, but you can decide to do whatever you want. You know, I've heard from a reasonable number of people that said, you know what, I kind of like doing one at a time for the time being. You know, they've been double booking, they've had the assistant and all that, and then pandemic hit, and then now they just kind of like the slower pace. So it's so interesting to see how this change has affected everybody really in their own specific ways. Some people are pounding it out now with double and triple booking because they've got the energy, they want to make up for the lost income, et cetera. Their clients are coming back more and more every week. So it's just very, very personal and individual.
Yeah.
Are you starting to see some of your clients coming back? Are you starting to get referrals again? And is kind of the foundation of your business coming back?
Yes, actually, since I've been back in the salon at Salon Republic, I've found that people are feeling more comfortable. They're getting vaccinated. Those people who have been not coming in for this whole time, I'm seeing that those roots, those really long roots, and people who have just been wearing ponytails and stuff. Also, I'm getting a lot of new referrals, and I'm not sure if that's just because it's new energy and it's a new environment, or people want to help me out or whatever. But I'm actually doing a lot more new clients than I did when I was back in Sally Hershberger, for example, and it's great. That's really great.
That's really interesting. I think you probably named a couple of the potential reasons. It's probably more of a personal experience for your clients. They recognize that all the money goes to you, and it's kind of like the whole small business thing, right? Like support small business. That's got to be a lot of it. And then I've heard that a lot of people like the one-on-one, the contained atmosphere. A lot of people don't want to be in the environment with a lot of different people. Some people don't care, but I've certainly heard from some clients that they prefer the one-on-one. So I'm super happy to hear that. You know, I try to not be very self-promotional on this podcast. I think a lot of the listeners who listen to us every week know that I don't talk a lot about Salon Republic at all. I certainly don't promote one way of working over another. That's never been our kind of the reason why we do this. But I wanted to have you on because there's you've undergone a shift, which I found was very, very interesting. And Modern Salon did the article on it, and I thought it would just be fantastic to have you on. So David talks about some of this stuff in the Modern article. For the listeners' sake, go to the show notes and hit the link to read that article. You're also an accomplished painter. Talk about that.
Okay, sure. I love to paint. When I was in grade school and high school, I always took art classes and I always did well. And I think I was 40, and one of my clients said that she took classes at this studio, and I said, oh, I've always wanted to take oil painting. And she was like, oh my God, you have to do this. I can totally see you doing this, and you have to do it. So I went and started taking classes, and again, discovered this talent that I didn't know I had. And I really love it. I really love doing it. And I think I'm pretty good at it.
So how often it's one of those things. It's like the ultimate art, right? You can do it, you cannot do it, you can do it in every different form, big scale, small scale, everything. And just really quick, my mom, I grew up in a household where my dad was a business person, my mom is an artist, and she was quite successful as an oil painter. She's painted many famous people, portraits, and she's done lots of different types of oil painting. So just about my entire life was spent around her art, taking place right down the hallway from my bedroom. So I get it. I understand a decent amount of the life of an artist. How do you do it? How often do you paint? What do you paint?
Well, I mostly enjoy doing, I've kind of tried different different types of painting, but I found that I most enjoy doing figurative, doing people. I like, you know, doing shadows and skin tones and expression and things like that. And the human body, I really enjoy doing those types of painting. I got to be honest, though, I have an 8-year-old boy, and I also work full time, and so I really I haven't been painting as much as I would like or as I used to.
Yeah.
But it's whenever I find the time. Which isn't very much lately.
Right.
But I still will go back to it now and then, and it's great.
So you talked about skin tones and shading and expressions and stuff like that. My mom was largely self-taught, and however, she was having trouble learning some elements of expression, facial expression, hands, you know, the parts of drawing and painting that are so difficult. But there was a very famous painter who was living about 3 hours south of us. I'm from Dallas, Texas. He was living in Austin, and so this was probably 20 years ago. She said to my dad that she's going to go down to Austin and she's going to just knock on this guy's door because he wasn't answering the phone, and he had, you know, gotten to an age where he was, you know, pretty old. And so she did that. She went down there, knocked on his door. He answered the door, and she spent about a month with him, learning all of those technical elements of shading, skin tones, facial expressions, and things like that. And ever since then, you know, she's been able to do things that few people can do. So I've always, you know, this is the type of household that I was brought up in, where people do these types of things and learn and teach themselves. And if they can't teach themselves, then they go and they seek out the knowledge. So where did you learn how to do stuff like that?
I went to the Klein Academy. It's in Culver City. And when I started out, they were actually in Santa Monica. And this woman, Cheryl Klein, she was my teacher, and she was amazing. You know, I think she can teach anybody to paint. And everybody that goes to her starts off doing this very elaborate color wheel. It's called a mandala, I think. And it teaches you how to mix color. It teaches you transitions and collisions, as they like to say. So blending and lines of direct color on color, and also I guess tinting and toning and all that stuff. It's was really difficult. It took me like a couple months to do this color wheel, and then. And then what she did was she has her students replicate a master painting. So she has you do a gray study of a famous painting that you like, and then slowly add color to it, and like you can recreate this like beautiful painting. And you were like, wow, it gives you the confidence to be like, man, I can actually paint. And then
which
cool.
did you do?
Which one did I do? Yeah. The painting. My first painting was by Hippolyte Flandrin. I can't pronounce his name, but
Dutch.
It's he's and it's of a boy on a beach. And it's you'd recognize it. I forget what the actual title of the painting is, but it's and it looks just like a real painting, pretty much. It's pretty funny.
That's awesome. What is something in your career that you wish you hadn't done?
Hadn't. That's a tough one, though, because I feel like there's not really mistakes in life, that every decision that you make and every path that you choose kind of takes you somewhere that is part of who you are. And whether you just learn from something, it's almost important that you go through that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that I have any regrets or mistakes.
Oh, look, that's a great answer. And I subscribe to the same philosophy. You know, there aren't losses. It's not wins or losses. It's wins or learnings, right?
Right.
Okay, so as we go towards the end of the conversation, David, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you want me to ask you? Anything that you want to talk about? Anything that maybe you're interested in, particularly passionate about in the industry right now?
Okay, here's one thing. I started out in my career doing coloring and cutting because I enjoy creating an entire look for my client. I don't like just doing half and then passing them over to somebody else to do the color, say, or you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I worked that way in the first two salons that I worked at. And then when I left Fred Siegel and went to Serge Nomon at John Frieda, I had to choose. They wanted me to work there, but I had to choose to be a colorist or a hairstylist, and because it's a departmentalized salon. So even though they allowed me to do both on my clients that I brought in, they still wanted me to be one or the other for any new clients that came in. So I chose color, thinking that would be a better financial choice, which I don't know if that's true or not, but I just said I would be a colorist. And so I kept with that for, even though I was still doing both coloring and cutting on, you know, the large percentage of my clientele, both at Sally Hershberger and at John Frieda. And I've decided that I really am glad to be out of that environment of being just one or the other. And now I feel like at Salon Republic, I have the freedom to truly express and be a full, complete stylist, if that's how I like to do hair, basically. Sure. So sure. That's been great, just to have that like creative or emotional freedom to, like, you know, be a colorist and a cutter and a straightener and whatever else I do, you know?
I love it. I love it. You know, I'm not a hairdresser, but I've been doing this 21 years, and I've heard so many variations of departmentalized, compartmentalized, you know, total independence, and everyone's perspective on it. And I think you expressed it really, really well. I think for me, if I did do hair, that would bother me as well, especially if I liked both. You know, if I thought I was a good cutter and I thought I was proficient and really good at color, I would want to do all of it.
Yeah.
So I totally get that. If you could wave a wand and change anything about the industry right now, what would it be?
Well, it's hard for me to say this now because I'm independent, but for people in who are working in salons, it would be nice to have health care, I guess, or benefits, retirement benefits or anything like that. And I feel like that's missing in this industry.
Yeah.
It's nice to have that security of if anything happens, you know,
right,
to have that insurance.
You can get things. You know, things have developed over the last, you know, well, if we're going to talk about technology to help you book your clients and stuff in the last 5 to 10 years, obviously, I know you use Square. I went on your website. As far as healthcare, disability, retirement, you can get all those things. We bring in, I don't know if we've done it since you've been in the salon, but we bring in certain providers that provide some of these services. And you can, of course, customize what you get from it. But I totally hear you on that. But it's difficult for a lot of salons to offer these types of benefits to their staff because it's so expensive.
Yes, I know. That's so true. I've always had my own insurance policies, but the coverage perhaps was not as good as if I would have, you know, gotten it through a company. You know what I mean?
Right. Do you have any hair horror stories?
Mostly my horror stories come from when I was first starting out, yes.
Do tell.
Oh my gosh. Well, the worst was when I was cutting this woman's like chin-length, jaw-length bob, and she had super thick hair. And after I'd cut it, it had made this beautiful, beautiful bob. But she had really thick hair, and I was cleaning up the edge of the bob, and I'm like having to close my scissors pretty heavily because her hair's so thick and everything. And all of a sudden, I felt the scissors like really grab something, and I cut part of her ear off. It was literally like this. It was like a skin thing, but it got on my. It like actually came off on my scissors, but
that's so gross.
Oh, of course I know, and of course the salon didn't have any Band-Aids or any antiseptic. They were almost like running around with Kleenexes and water, trying to.
And what was she doing?
Well, she was actually pretty cool with it. She's like, "Oh, did you cut my ear?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm terribly sorry. I'm so sorry." And well, needless to say, I never saw her again. But I didn't charge her for that haircut.
That's probably good. So wait a second. She very calmly said, "Oh, did you cut my ear?" Like, yeah. It doesn't hurt?
Well, apparently the scissors were so sharp, and it was, you know, not like her whole ear lobe that came off. It was just part of her like skin. But and I guess it luckily it didn't like bleed a lot.
Okay, but, that's good.
Man, yeah. That's,
all right. So that was for the benefit of the listeners. How many years was that after you were on the floor of a salon?
Oh, it was within the first year that I was on the floor. Okay. That happened.
So it happens, people. It happens, and it hasn't happened since then. So, what did you change after having that experience? In your technique or you're just thinking or what?
You know, you have to be very careful. And I was, and I have been since then, just not to, be very conscious of where people's ears are.
Oh my God. All right. Any last words for the community?
No, I just feel very grateful and very lucky to have chosen this path and this career. It's really been, great for me. I've been so happy. I feel like the luckiest person to actually go into work every day and not feel like it's work or dread it. I've never, ever had that experience where, oh, I do not want to get out of bed. I do not want to do this. It's just been such a – and I get paid for it. That's like getting paid to do what I love to do. It's fantastic.
That's the dream.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, David. Thanks for being part of Salon Republic. Thanks for doing this interview, and I hope to see you soon in the salon.
I'd like that too. Thanks, Eric. I appreciate it.
All right, guys, I'm back. The Pod Loot is changing. The first episode of every month, we're going to give away $500 cash to one lucky winner. For a chance to win, write a review on the Apple Podcast app. The review has to include your exact Instagram handle. That's how we know who you are. Make sure you're following the Hair Game Podcast and me, Love Eric Taylor, on Instagram. And then I put your name in a bag. On the first episode of every month, I pull a name and I announce the winner. You have to be listening to win. The winner has to DM us within 2 weeks of when we release the episode to claim the money. If you don't win, keep listening because your name stays in my bag in the office. You can win the next drawing. For complete details, go to salonrepublic.com. Next week's episode will be with Nick Arojo. Until then, have a great week.